From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Republicans met behind closed doors this morning and failed to reach a deal on immigration. Afterwards, House Speaker Paul Ryan was asked if his impending retirement is making it difficult for him to corral moderates who want to force votes on immigration bills.
No, I don't think that's it at all. It's just that this is a difficult issue. And what we've been trying to do is go through the regular committee process, Homeland Security Committee, Judiciary Committee, to get 218 votes for a bill. We don't have 218 votes for that bill. So now we're trying to figure out where that sweet spot is.
Joining us now is Scott Detrow, who covers Congress for NPR. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
And it sounds like they didn't find that sweet spot just yet. But why were they having this meeting now?
Sure. Well, as you will remember, all year long, especially in the early part of the year, there was a push to provide to find some sort of permanent fix for people in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That process really stalled out a few months ago when it was clear there was no path forward because President Trump was insisting any fix for DACA also had to involve billions and billions of dollars for border security, including a border wall, as well as big fixes for the legal immigration system as well. There was just not bipartisan support for that plan. Things have really stayed in a holding pattern since then and has really frustrated a group of moderate Republicans. So they made a decision to go forward with something called a discharge petition, which is a parliamentary move that hardly ever works. But if you get enough signatures, you can force a vote on the floor of the House on an issue. They're very close now. They just need three more signatures. Paul Ryan does not want that to happen. And that's why they held this meeting today.
Well, and it sounded from Paul Ryan's remarks today like he doesn't think that that will happen. Is that right?
It's unclear. Ryan and many other Republican leaders came out of this meeting saying the people behind the discharge petition have agreed to put it on hold as long as there's some sort of progress. We have not gotten a clear indication from the people behind the petition that they actually have agreed to that as well. So we're waiting to see how that plays out today. Here's one thing that Ryan said, though. He said that a discharge petition, whatever measure passes there, would not become law. There wouldn't be enough support for it in the Senate or support from President Trump. Here's the problem with Ryan's argument. What he's pushing for is that broad approach that President Trump wants. You'll hear him and others call it the four pillars approach,
right,
where you have a permanent fix for DACA, the border security, changes to legal immigration. That came up for a vote in the Senate a couple months ago, and it did not even get 40 votes. So that is not a feasible path forward, because the problem is enough Republicans do not want some sort of broad legalization path, and enough Democrats say they're absolutely not going to vote for any changes to the legal immigration process. You get the stalemate, which we continue to be in, and which today's meeting made no progress toward fixing.
What are we hearing from Democrats? What do they want in an immigration deal? And are Republicans going to need them to get anything passed?
Yeah, there is a bipartisan compromise solution here, at least theoretically. And it's the plan that you may remember several senators put together, Lindsey Graham on the Republican side, Jeff Flake as well, Dick Durbin on the Democratic side. The basic trade-off that many Democrats have said they are willing to do is to vote for billions of dollars for border security, to vote for what President Trump would be able to claim victory as and say he's getting his border wall, which was a key part of his run for president. That's something Democrats don't like, but they're saying, yeah, sure, we will vote for a border wall if you get this, if there's some sort of fix for DACA. President Trump went beyond that and saying, no, we need to deal with legal immigration as well. And Democrats have by and large said, no, we're not going to make that trade-off because we don't think drastically curtailing legal immigration is worth it to fix DACA, even though they really want to fix DACA. So Democrats have not really been involved in the process the last few weeks. I think at this point, Democrats feel like if they win control of the House of Representatives, they can put forward a bill on their own terms next year.
Can you imagine a scenario where both the House and the Senate are able to agree on something and then President Trump says he's not going to sign it because it doesn't give him what he wants?
I think I could imagine that scenario, actually. I think with President Trump more than a lot of other presidents. I mean, President Trump has changed his mind on DACA over and over and over again, going back to the way last fall, the beginning of September, when this first came to the forefront. President Trump said he wanted to fix DACA. This is, of course, after he put in place the process of it expiring.
Right.
Now, the expiration is on hold because the federal court system did not allow DACA to expire in March as it was supposed to. And because Congress is such a deadline-driven organization, that was a big factor among anything else. to keep this in the holding pattern because there was no deadline to force the compromise. Therefore, no compromise happened. So the moderate Republicans behind this discharge petition have been hoping that this would create some urgency. Right now, it's unclear what happens next. If they move forward and force this vote, that would be a big embarrassment to House Republican leaders. But there might be enough votes from these moderate Republicans and Democrats to pass a measure that deals with that more narrow compromise, the DACA for border security compromise.
That's Scott Detrow, who covers Congress for NPR. Scott, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, today, Russia's President Putin says other countries are wrong to see Russia as a threat and that their sanctions don't serve their own interests. Russia has been hit by sanctions from the U.S. and others over its 2014 annexation of Crimea from Ukraine and its support for rebels fighting the Ukrainian government in eastern Ukraine. Western countries also expelled Russian diplomats after accusations that Moscow poisoned a former Russian spy in the U.K. Well, the Russian leader touched on these and many other topics in his annual TV call-in show. The BBC's Sergei Gorashko joins us from Moscow. And Sergei, tell us more about what Putin said about sanctions. And is he saying this just for domestic consumption? Because it's not likely, you know, the West cares about what he says on this.
Well, actually, you're absolutely right, because this whole direct line, this whole fall-in is absolutely for the domestic consumption, of course, to try it. Trying to show people that he actually managed the situation, trying to persuade them that Russia isn't doing anything wrong, and the sanctions are coming out of the United States of America, who are trying to restrain Russia, which is also wrong, and that's why we have some problems inside our country because of Americans who are trying to restrain Russia. But the interesting point was that Vladimir Putin mentioned the possibility of the Third World War. He told that this understanding that the Third World War is possible should stop the other countries, like the global nuclear powers, from attacking each other. And he mentioned that this war could be the end of civilization that should restrain us from taking the extreme steps. That is the quote.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, who was he talking to? I mean, are you saying that it might have been a message to North Korea or to the U.S.? I mean, what was he saying when he said that nuclear weapons might produce a Third World War?
It's difficult to answer what Putin actually wanted to say, but I think in this case, he was talking about the United States of America, of course.
Look, this show, which we listen every year, is about showing...
Yeah, for 16 years already.
About showing how strong he is, too, because it goes on for hours. And they show these pictures of banks of people, presumably operators, taking these questions. And it seems as if, I mean, are questions not allowed? Because, for instance, he was asked about the former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, who, you know, Britain believes were poisoned by Russia. So the question got through. What did he say? And what does it tell you that a question like that gets through?
As for the question about Yulia Skripal, he told that if Russia actually used a chemical weapon, Yulia Skripal and her father, Sergei Skripal, the former Russian spy, would be dead. That's what Vladimir Putin told.
Wait, he said if we did it, they'd be dead. We wouldn't have failed.
Well, yes, that's what he told. And Russia is waiting for the meeting with Yulia Skripal and Russian consular in Great Britain.
Oh boy. Well, what do you think, though? I mean, are these questions? They're screened, obviously. Do you think there are questions that aren't allowed through?
Well, the situation has changed a bit during the last years. Today, we can see on the screen some really harsh questions about when Vladimir Putin will resign, why Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition leader, wasn't allowed to go to the elections in March 2018, why do we have such corruption in the country. But we can only see these questions on the screen, like they're sent via SMS, but Putin never answered any of them. But it shows that, we have some freedom of speech and every question is allowed. But Vladimir Putin just decides which questions he wants to answer and which he doesn't want.
Well, that's fascinating. So you could see questions that he didn't answer. But anything else about you that, you know, the tone, anything, you know, people reading more the tea leaves of it, anything that struck you?
the thing that was interesting this year, that Vladimir Putin decided to ask officials, governors and ministers to join him answering questions of citizens. And practically each question asked by anybody from the country was then readdressed to some official who was trying to explain why something bad is happening. Because all questions, practically all questions from the Russian regions were about why do we have such high prices? Why don't we have such high prices for gasoline, for instance? And in each situation like that, Putin asked some official, like a governor or a minister, to answer for him, like he's not making himself responsible for that, but making some other person responsible.
Brilliant, some would say.
Well, yeah. Brilliant from Vladimir Putin, yes. Yeah.
The BBC's Sergei Goryashko in Moscow after today's annual Vladimir Putin television show. Sergei, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
It's finally time to begin our recommendations for summer reading. And we start with In the Distance, a book you may have missed when it was published last fall after first-time author Hernan Diaz answered an open call for manuscripts from the nonprofit Coffee House Press in Minneapolis. Then everyone sat up in April when it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. It reads at times like a dystopian tale as an immigrant Swede makes his way across this country, sometime between the Gold Rush and the Civil War, a country that feels at times like post-apocalypse America, with crazed gold miners, a murderous cult that masquerades as Native Americans as it rapes and pillages, a wagon train of homesteaders. But then there's also the mysticism. Crossing an empty desert, he's blinded by a light. It's a mirror on the open door of a massive wardrobe, sensuous spirals and scrawls in the bleached wood. How did it get there? In fact, Kirkus Review says, In the Distance is Cormac McCarthy by way of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And Hernan Diaz joins us from the NPR studios to talk about it. Welcome and congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me.
Where did this all come from, this idea of an immigrant Swede crossing America?
Part of it has to do with the fact that I grew up in Sweden, so it's not as weird or whimsical as one might suppose.
And you weren't born there?
I was born in Argentina. I left when I was two. I spent my whole childhood and moved back to Argentina, went to college. And then as soon as I could, I left and moved to London. And I've been in New York for the last 20 years.
So you've been a stranger in a strange land several times.
Yes, and that went into the book.
Well, and I'm trying to describe how it's presented. You have your character enter the scene in the most extraordinary way. He crawls out of ice towards an icebreaker outside Alaska?
Outside Alaska, yes. I wanted him to emerge, a birth-like scene, from out of nowhere, almost as if he had been devoured and expelled by the landscape. And you can tell which way is up or down because it's all white, even the sky. And all of a sudden, this naked body emerges out of nothingness.
And don't worry, we find out what he's doing there by the end of the book. But
yes.
But then you take us back to how he even got to this country. He, Håkan, am I saying that right? Håkan?
Håkan,
the Swede,
yes.
Has been separated from his adored brother Linus as they left Sweden. He's now stranded in San Francisco, Linus in New York. His Homeric goal, Håkan's, is to find his brother. So he travels cross-country, moving against this tide of settlers going the other way.
That's right.
And he knows nothing. So, you know, Western novels presume that we know what the desert looks like. Through his eyes, we're on the moon.
It's funny that you say that because throughout the writing process of the book, I thought of planet Mars in early science fiction, a land nobody had been to, but that had very specific rules and a specific fauna and flora and topography. And that was the West I was interested in, a fictional West. And you're totally correct. He has no idea of where he is. He doesn't even know the Earth is round. He doesn't speak a word of English. He has no money.
And he's huge.
He never stops growing, yes.
Why did you do that?
The practical reason was that at one point in the book, he commits a terrible act of violence. And he is destroyed morally by it. And I wanted him to be unable to hide. So making him massive was an obvious response to that. And the second reason was, I don't know why, but I was attracted to the idea of this gigantic body in this gigantic landscape.
Well, that's kind of the mystical part of it, because it does edge toward you know, the mythical creatures, the King Kongs, Paul Bunyan. Yeah. It's Paul Bunyan,
oh,
only
Paul
from
Bunyan.
Sweden.
Yes, of course. Yes, but I was always careful to keep Håkan a normal human being.
Right.
He's I think at one point it says he was as large as he could possibly be while still remaining human. This is not a magical realist book at all. And you're right about the mystical part, but rather than thinking about magic, I think there is a strong transcendental vein in the book. There's a character who's a naturalist who owes a lot to Emerson and that whole tradition, and that's where I find the more mystical strand of the novel.
Yeah, the naturalist that he travels with has a Hosanna moment where he's sort of realizing, actually, evolution. You know, he's kind of rethinking things under the stars.
He almost gets it.
Almost gets
not
it.
Not quite, yeah.
Well, but staying with Håkan and
yes.
his
great.
Size, you know, when he comes into town, though, he does, you do have a bit of the traditional Western in that it's when the stranger comes to town, everybody comes out and gawks at him.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. In Håkan's case, you mentioned he commits this act saving people from, you know, atrocity, but he still hates every moment of it. I read that you really had a hard time writing that.
Yes, I almost gave up the whole book because I knew that the story I wanted to tell entailed that moment. And when it came to do it, I found that I couldn't. And it's actually very, very, very brief, maybe 4 to 6 sentences. But going back to what you were saying, the hero walking into a dusty road, there are many stereotypical moments like that in the book, and they're very, very intentional. And I wanted to play with those slightly ossified, petrified tropes of the Western and try to turn them into something new.
Our Swede goes from being an outcast who lands on the shores to this unintended outlaw to legend. And he's huge. And I'm wondering at times, you know, could he be a stand-in for America itself?
I did want to, in a way, condense and coalesce different narratives of our country into this story, and in particular into this character who is at the same time an absolute outcast, but also very much the moral center of the book. And it is also a way because the book is set mostly before the Civil War, and most Westerns are post-Civil War. This is a book about the United States in the throes of becoming itself. Mm. And I was interested in re-examining that period of our history.
He travels and he travels. We realize how hard it was to make your way across America when you had to feed yourself, you had to clothe yourself. His life becomes, for years at a time, simply sustaining his life. In fact, there's a passage, if you would read it for us, which describes some of the travels that we've heard.
He travels on foot for years. He crossed deserts and forded rivers, climbed mountains and traversed plains. He ate fish and prairie dogs, slept on moss and sand, skinned caribou and iguanas. His face became wrinkled by many summers and furrowed by many winters. His hands, burned and frostbitten year after year, were crossed and recrossed with lines and creases. Once he saw the ocean, but turned around immediately, thinking there would be settlements along the coastline. Whenever he stopped, it was in an inhospitable location, never in a meadow, by a water source, or in a plentiful spot, barely pitching camp, and seldom making fires. It was dead quiet in his mind. He rarely thought of anything that was not at hand. Years vanished under a weightless present. Through countless frosts and thaws, he walked in circles wider than nations. And then he stopped.
But we're like him. We don't know, Hernán, how long did he walk?
He walks for, I would say, a few decades.
Oh, man.
Yes.
And to what end? Is it metaphor for something, or did you just want to see what would happen to someone if they tried to cross this country by foot in the 1800s?
It's not a metaphor for one single thing. I was not interested in his arrival. I was more interested in his disorientation, in the experience of being completely and absolutely lost and experiencing complete and absolute loss, both things.
Of course, it resonates so now because of the, you know, millions of migrants around the world. Were you thinking of that?
I am firsthand familiar with uprootedness and the experience of being an immigrant or even a refugee in Sweden.
And we should say you and your family had to flee Argentina because of your parents' activism. So you know about that dislocation.
Exactly. So that for sure was in my mind at all times. Obviously, I couldn't foresee the current events, but I am glad, if that's the correct word for this horrible situation, that this book can be a sort of commentary or an intervention into what is going on right now.
Again, the book In the Distance, it made me want to travel out west again, even though there's such hardship, but there's such beauty. But do I understand this doesn't come from your love of traveling through that part of the... You have never been to these places.
I've been to very few of them, and I decided very actively not to go to any of these places and rent a car and have sort of an air-conditioned experience of the characters' ordeals. It seemed to me slightly I'm sure I would have learned a lot from it, but I wanted to stick with literary sources, travel narrative from the 19th century, and something that sometimes is forgotten when people talk about fiction and start going about research. I wanted to rely on imagination, my imagination, to imagine these places from scratch.
Wow. It's just one of the best descriptions of the American West by an Argentinian who grew up in Sweden and had never been there. It's just great. Aaron Diaz's book is In the Distance. It's our pick for a summer read, especially if you're traveling through the country. Hernán, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
NASA scientists are back in touch with a probe in deep space. After months in hibernation mode, about 3.7 billion miles from Earth, the New Horizons spacecraft got a wake-up call from scientists earlier this week. They've put the spacecraft on a new course toward a mysterious part of Earth's outer solar system. Daniel Potter from member station KQED says this mission may reveal new clues about how planets form.
The space probe New Horizons sent us photos a few years ago of Pluto with a giant heart shape on its surface made of frozen nitrogen.
Today, a spacecraft sailed past the dwarf planet Pluto for the very first time, snapping pictures and taking measurements.
NPR's Robert Siegel in 2015. Pluto surprised us. It's more complex than we guessed and may hold liquid water. But the New Horizons probe has more work to do. I caught up with the head of the mission's geology and geophysics imaging team.
My name is Jeff Moore. I'm a research scientist here at NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California.
One other discovery from that 2015 flyby, Pluto's moon Charon has a strange mountain. Moore says the surface around it is weirdly sunken, almost like it has a moat.
We were surprised to see that and had lots of crazy theories on what formed it. Of course, being a 2001 A Space Odyssey fan, I suggested we name it Kubrick Mons.
After the sci-fi movie's director, Stanley Kubrick.
Which, by the way, is now the official name.
Now New Horizons is heading toward its next target, a billion miles farther out, an object called 2014 MU69. Its common name is much cooler.
A target we've nicknamed Ultima Thule.
This is Alan Stern, the mission's top scientist.
It's a Norse saying for beyond the farthest frontiers.
This space rock is nearly the size of a county, maybe 20 miles across. Researchers don't know much about it. It hadn't even been spotted when New Horizons left Earth 12 years ago. It's in a part of the solar system called the Kuiper, or Kuiper Belt, where not much has changed in the last 4 billion years.
The Kuiper Belt really is the equivalent of an archaeological dig into the history of our solar system.
What this space rock is made of could tell us about the raw ingredients floating around back when the planets first formed. It's been chilling way out in cold storage ever since.
Because it's so far away and the sunlight is so weak out there, temperatures are very low, almost absolute zero, and that promotes the preservation of pristine material.
David Grinspoon wrote a book with Stern about New Horizons. He says the goal is to figure out the primordial building blocks our young solar system started with, based on what's still on the playroom floor.
It's like if the planets were made out of some sort of a big giant box of Legos and, you know, it was sort of messy and then nobody really cleaned up afterwards, you could go and like find the bits that didn't become planets and then examine them.
Over the next few months, scientists will start pointing New Horizons cameras toward Ultima Thule and fine-tune its course this fall. They're already looking forward to the holidays. If all goes well, the probe will make its closest approach overnight this New Year's Eve. For Here and Now, I'm Daniel Potter.
A white restaurant manager from Conway, South Carolina, pleaded guilty in federal court this week to one count of forced labor. Authorities say that Bobby Paul Edwards physically and verbally abused an African-American cook, Christopher Smith, and forced him to work without pay. Smith, the cook, also has an intellectual disability. So how could this happen in public view at a restaurant? Charisse Jones of USA Today joins us now with more. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
And just tell us more about what happened at this restaurant called J&J Cafeteria. When did the abuse start?
Yeah, you know, Mr. Smith had started working at J&J when he was 12 years old, and he's about 40 now. And in 2009, Edwards came on as manager and began this horrific cycle of abuse, you know, basically hitting him with pots and pans, beating him with a belt, hurling racial epithets, even taking tongs dipped in grease and burning his neck. And it didn't end until 2014 when it was reported. Law enforcement came in and charges were eventually filed.
And Edwards, the restaurant manager, could face 20 years in prison. How did authorities find out about this case?
You know, it's not clear who reported it. It probably was patrons or customers who saw this. There might have even been other restaurant workers who observed it and finally reported it. It's not really clear, but somebody finally went to law enforcement and they were able to come in and get him out of that horrific situation.
Well, and in a statement from the Justice Department, John Gore, who is the acting assistant attorney general, said that human trafficking through forced labor can happen on farms, in homes, and even in these public places like restaurants. What do we know about how prevalent this kind of thing is?
You know, we don't have a specific count, but people who've looked into it believe that there are many thousands of workers who are being exploited in this way. Many of them are immigrants, and they're on construction sites, on farms, in hotels, in restaurants, and also in private homes where they're being used as domestic labor.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is it's like you can imagine it happening on a farm, but in a restaurant, how could this be hidden?
You know, you don't always have to hide it. I mean, first of all, the abuse may not be happening when there are other people around. But secondly, these employers use fear and intimidation to keep these workers under control. And so even though they might be exposed to the public, the fear of being deported, of leaving and then having to come back and face even greater abuse keeps them silent. And so they don't always reach out to a customer or an inspector at a work site to say what's happening to them. And that's how this vice keeps its grip on these workers.
For business owners or bosses that do this, that abuse their workers or force them to work without pay, how likely are they to get caught? What's the penalty?
Well, there's not really a great likelihood. I mean, the public is not really aware of it. It's not a priority for law enforcement. They look more for sex traffickers than labor exploiters. But if they do get caught, like in the case with Edwards, he's facing up to 20 years in prison, a $250,000 fine, and he's got to try and compensate financially Mr. Smith for what he did. But, you know, Mr. Smith, in the end, was one of the lucky ones because somebody reported this and law enforcement intervened, and that's often not the case.
Charisse, you're African American. What did you think when you heard this story? Did this surprise you?
You know, it did. I mean, it was very painful. I mean, basically, this man was enslaved. I mean, to try and imagine, you know, him dealing with this for so many years. And you wonder, you know, did he have family? Was there anybody that knew what was happening to him? And how could this person, you know, use this kind of language and inflict this kind of abuse in this day and age? And so it was really unsettling. And I think that we often think illegal immigrants are the ones subjected to this, which is also horrific. But to think that someone who's been there their entire life, you know, going through something like this is incredibly troubling. And I'm just glad that he was able to get help and get out of there.
Yeah. That's Charisse Jones of USA Today. Charisse, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we told you recently how more people in the U.S. are getting sick from bugs. In a recent study, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that cases of people sickened by mosquito and flea bites and ticks tripled from 2004 to 2016. Tripled. And when it comes to ticks, we aren't just talking about Lyme disease. Researchers have found 7 new tick-borne germs in that time. Ray Ellen Bichelle takes us to Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado, where scientists are hunting for some rare but nasty viruses.
Dan Salkeld estimates he's collected 6,000 or 7,000 ticks over his career, and he actually likes it. He's a disease ecologist at Colorado State University, and he came today dressed in a short-sleeved T-shirt and a baseball hat.
I've turned into tick cowboy. Nothing's going to go wrong with me.
His partner in tick hunting today is Alyssa Beck. She took a different tack.
She's bought a Tyvek suit because she's nervous.
I'm not nervous.
Beck says she's collected far too many ticks by accident. So to protect herself, she's zipping into Tyvek, a full-body plastic suit, the kind you get at Home Depot for painting a house. It even has a hood.
How ridiculous do I look already?
Like the marshmallow in Ghostbusters.
They pull out white flannel flags. That's what they'll use to entice the ticks out of the grass and bushes.
Okay, ready? Let's go this way.
They aren't so interested in the ticks themselves as they are in what might be hiding inside the bugs, specifically two viruses. One of them is called Colorado tick fever.
And apparently it's, like, horrendous.
The virus gives people fever, chills, aches, and fatigue. There's no treatment.
But then it's, I think, self-curing, so you don't have chronic impacts later on.
But they're also looking for something else, something much worse. It's called Powassan virus, and it's a nasty one currently hitting the Northeast and Midwest. Powassan can give people anything from a fever and headache to brain swelling, confusion, seizures, and even memory loss.
And it can be fatal.
So, is Powassan heading to Colorado? Turns out, it's been here already.
It was found in 1960, but few people have looked ever since.
But now, Salkeld and Beck are on it. They're hiking through Ponderosa Pine Forest, dragging those white flannel flags across the ground.
I like to undulate as we go.
Like a frolicking deer.
Yeah, exactly.
We're about 8,000 feet up, with a backdrop of stunning Rocky Mountains.
Nothing yet.
Oh, no, that's just a regular bug.
And about 15 minutes in, no ticks.
Nothing.
And then, finally, there it was.
And there's a tick.
Yes.
So now this one is going in a vial.
From there on out, it was pretty much ticks galore.
Another one.
Another one.
Yeah, we got two in one go. So, and there's a fourth.
Oh no, you got one there.
What, are you? Yeah, oh my gosh, they're probably on me too now.
By the end of the day, Salkeld and Beck had nearly 100 ticks.
That's like a writhing ball
and
of ticks.
And that's a little, yeah, that's a little tick orgy.
Yep, that's what it looks like.
The tick orgy will eventually make its way to the lab bench of this scientist.
So I'm Alex Baez.
So you're officially the tick grinder and virus extractor.
That is my job today, yes.
On other days, Alex Baez is a veterinarian. She's also working on a PhD studying West Nile virus. But today, it's ticks.
Here's some ticks.
Baez takes a Ziploc bag with vials of ticks out of the fridge. They look dead, but they aren't. Bias needs them alive to keep the potential viruses inside them fresh.
So they're all balled up because they're really cold. but once you take them out and bring them back up to room temperature, they'll get really active, which makes them sometimes kind of hard to pull out of the tubes. But
because they're like wiggling around?
They're crawling around. They crawl over each other. They like to grab onto the forceps. They can be surprisingly fast.
Bias will wrangle the reawakened ticks into little tubes with some liquid and a metal ball. Then she'll plop those into a machine that's somehow very appropriately called Retch.
They actually look kind of like coffee grounds.
Yeah, they do kind of look like coffee grounds. Ticks, smithereens.
She'll take those smithereens and separate out the liquid, the part that might have viruses floating around inside. And then test for Colorado tick fever and Powassan virus. But she says you never know what else you might find.
Essentially, you're looking for things when you don't know exactly what's going to be in there. And that's how sometimes viruses that we don't even know about are discovered.
Bias and her colleagues should have answers about what diseases the ticks are carrying by the end of the summer. But they'll keep collecting and checking in years to come, because things are always changing. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
A ball of tick orgy. An image I do not think I'll soon get out of my mind. That story came to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
Imagine getting paid to move to a new state and still keep your current job. Well, thanks to the new remote worker grant program in Vermont, you might soon be able to do that if you move to Vermont. Last week, the governor there, Phil Scott, signed legislation that would pay people up to $10,000 to move to the state in 2019. The money could go towards moving costs or to pay rent in a co-working space. Joining us now is Joan Goldstein, commissioner of the Vermont Department of Economic Development. She's working on putting together this program. Joan, welcome. And what kind of person do you imagine would do this? Is it like a Facebook employee who would start doing their job remotely from Vermont?
Yes, all kinds of people. I mean, I have to say, since the governor signed it in last week, we have received nearly 1,000 emails from individuals that are interested with their stories. So from PhDs, writers, software developers, architect drafters, you know, all kinds of people are asking about how they could participate in this program. So I think it kind of reflects the economy that the world is in. Actually, we've received inquiries from all over the nation, but all over the world, the independent nature of work right now and the dependency upon kind of communications structures to do your work from anywhere.
And what's the rationale for Vermont? Why does Vermont want to do this and pay people to do this?
So Vermont is a very, very small state. I mean, we have just shy of 630,000 people, and we're the third oldest state in terms of demographic. So that's a very challenging environment in order to maintain vitality of the communities. The governor recognized, the legislature recognized, we need more people in the state. And so we need to try different things, new things. And it's interesting to see how many people are interested in Vermont. It's not really a surprise. There's like millions of visitors each year. Mm-hmm. So we want to figure out a way that we could turn visitors and people who love the state into residents.
But I imagine that for this to work, you're going to have, you know, the highest speed internet available, et cetera, so that people can really work remotely from Vermont.
Yes, correct. And we do have broadband in most of the downtowns all over the state. In fact, Burlington has fiber, gigabit, so does Springfield, and so does some small of the towns on the west side of the state. So there is that recognition. Obviously, there's more work to do, especially in the kind of last mile and on the back roads. But we do have sufficient to at least have it in the co-working spaces that are located throughout the state.
Do you want specifically young workers to come in?
I think any age is great, all right? People do focus on younger workers, millennials. We've gotten, just from the response, everybody from just recent college grads up until people that are in their 60s. So I'd say we're equal opportunity. We don't want to just have one type of person here. I moved up to Vermont when I was in my mid-40s, and I think it's good for any age.
I know that there are some in Vermont who are unhappy about this. They believe that this money could be better spent on workers who are already in the state. How do you respond to that?
Sure, sure. I mean, we don't think that this is the panacea, that this is going to solve all of our demographic issues. There are a fair amount of programs available currently for workers in the state. You know, we started at the session where we wanted this type of incentive to appeal to not only remote workers, but people who are going to work from bricks and mortar organizations. But like any legislation, you don't get everything that you ask for. There'll always be critics. There'll be fans. We need net influx of people, and this is one step in that direction.
What else besides money are you using to try to lure people in? I mean, Vermont, I will give you, it is an absolutely beautiful state. But what other kinds of things are being used to convince people to move there?
Sure. So the beauty, you know, can't be underestimated. If you have an option of where you want to work, why would you not want to work in a much more aesthetically pleasing place? The second thing that really attracts the outdoor recreation folks, right? So if you like to ski or hike or fish or garden or any of the outdoor sorts of recreation, it's plentiful. And the other thing that the smaller scale allows people to really make a difference, if you're in a small community, they're dependent upon people people to volunteer to help make the place a better environment. So you have ample opportunity to make a difference, and it's noticed. Part of this and another program we have is what we're calling the Stay to Stay Weekend, where people come up for a weekend to stay, and then on Monday we arrange introductions for them to meet different employers, look for a house, check out different co-working spaces as a way to give them a taste of what it would be like to be here.
Are you worried that New Hampshire is going to offer $11,000 or something? One of your neighboring states are going to try to compete with this?
I'm sure they will. I mean, this sort of issue and demographic is not unique to Vermont. Most of New England is dealing with this. In fact, most of rural areas in general are dealing with this issue as more and more people move to metropolitan areas. So, yeah, we fully expect there's going to be competition for sure.
That's Joan Goldstein, who is Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Economic Development. Joan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Robin, we could do that. Go do the show from Vermont.
Yes, now.
Especially now. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.